Okay. So I'd like to make this year in memory of Rav Avram ben Yona Yaakov, who is the father of a friend of mine who passed away. And they asked me to do this today and tomorrow this year in his memory. So now some more serious warnings. First of all, we're talking about the Jewish History of the World, Part 1, which has nothing to do with the Mel Brooks movie of a similar name. Second of all, I hated history for many, many years and never, ever enjoyed it. And then in the last few years, I suddenly realized that everything makes so much more sense when you understand the basic history that goes around it. So my main goal today is just to try and have a general, very general overview of different kinds, different eras in Jewish history and different ideas, and also to look at the evolution of Torah through different periods in history. And something that I never really, no one ever gave me a shear on, is to just put it in context of what's happening in outside the Jewish world at similar times. Now, history is not a science. History is, as its name implies, a story, and it's, of course, a white male story. That's why it's his story. And I make no apologies. I just put down, in terms of the non-Jewish sources, I just put down things that I've heard of. There's nothing here from South America, even though the Mayan Incan cultures had all sorts of things happening. There's very little from the Chinese, the Asian world. There's nothing at all from New Zealand or Australia, strangely enough. And nothing from North America except Leif Erikson at the very bottom. That's partly because very little happened from a white male perspective in those places, and also because if it did, I didn't know about it. Yes? I knew I should have got you to do the photocopy. No, I don't. I'm sorry. Either share it or make a copy. Sorry. Also in the dates, if the non-Jewish events are as accurate as I could get or guess or make up, and sometimes I cheated. I also did this in the wee hours of the morning, so I may have just made tremendous mistakes, especially because numbers go backwards before Jesus. So I get very confused by that. Also, on the Jewish side, Jewish history is in the same way as pretty much all history until the very modern era, is stories which later people put together to try and make a history out of it. The Chumash very rarely gives dates of things, and if it does give dates, they're very rarely useful dates that we can definitively state. And even when they are definitive, there's often another source that contradicts it. That's for things that are in the Chumash or in the Tanakh. For things that are not in the Tanakh, we have the Gemara and statements of the early rabbis, which make things much more confusing. Again, they're telling stories of things that happened in earlier times, and historically, not necessarily historically accurate. In addition, the later authorities, the medieval Jewish commentaries, very often are quite happy to ignore what the earliest history said and just rewrite history. So the most basic things, such as when did Avraham first come to Israel, or how long were the Jews in Egypt for, or how long was when was the first base of Mikdash built? All of these things, which are fairly basic ideas and stories in Judaism, there's no definitive date for them, and there are differences of opinions amongst the medieval commentaries and the later commentaries and whatever. So everything is all approximate, but hopefully it'll be good enough for me to tell a story about some Torah. So let's try and do that. So if you look on page 2, which is always a good place to start. The Gemara says Jewish history is very, very simple. I'll read the Hebrew because and if there's mistakes in the English, most of them are my mistakes. Talmud of Eliyahu. It was taught in the Beis Midrash, in the school of Eliyahu, who's probably Eliyahu HaNavi. It says, Sheshes Alafim Shana Havi Ha'olam. The world will exist for 6,000 years. Shnei Alafim Tohu. 2,000 years of chaos. Like before creation. It says, Ha'aretz Haisa Tohu Vavo. The world was empty and shockingly empty. I think my son, when he was 5, came home from school translating, shockingly empty. So 2,000 years of like nothingness, then Shnei Alafim Torah, 2,000 years of Torah, and Shnei Alafim Yemos HaMashiach, and 2,000 years, days of Mashiach. Fantastic. However, the Gemara was written when we should have already been in the time of Mashiach, is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. So it says, Bavonaseinu Sherabu Yatzu Min Mashi Yatzu Mehem. So because of our sins, we've already used up some of the time that should have been the time of Mashiach, and he still hasn't come yet. And that was 1,500 years ago they wrote that, 1,200, 1,300, 1,400 years ago, and he still hasn't come, and we're still using up the time, and he hasn't come because of our sins. So Jewish history is very simple, 6,000 years, 2,000, 2,000, 2,000, just doesn't quite work, but that's our fault, not God's, and not history's fault, so wonderful. And this is the main source for the idea that Mashiach has to come by the year 6,000, if you've ever heard that idea. Yes?
What about meaning he's wasn't. I understand it to be like that Mashiach could come either in his time, like the designated time, or we can
be Tachishem,
right? So definite. So does that mean that it hasn't been his time yet? So how could that be?
It's the time when Mashiach could come. I don't know what it means. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know how it fits in with all the other stories about Mashiach, all the other Gemaras about Mashiach. You're right. Good point. But I'm going to ignore the good questions because I'm trying to go. You're right, 100% right. The point I want from here is the 6,000 years. Yeah.
Haven't we passed a few 6,000 years?
Well, we're going to start 5770 in a month's time, according to the current counting. I don't think we've passed 6,000 years in any of the Jewish calendars. Certainly since the dinosaurs has been more than 6,000 years, right? So let's look at source number two, right? Dinosaurs brings me to source number two, which is, I'm not going to talk about dinosaurs. Maybe another time we can talk about evolution and creation, things like that. But the Mishnah in Chagiga says very clearly, anyone who looks at four things or investigates or inquires after four areas of knowledge, it would be better had he not been created. What are those four things? Mala, 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 mata, mala, fnim, mala, achor. What's above, what's below, what's before, and what's after. Now, I don't really know what that means, but one understanding of that is what's above and what's below means how things work in heaven and how things work in the heaven, like on earth, whatever. Mala, fnim, what came before creation, and mala, achor, what's going to be after when Mashiach comes, or after the 6,000 years, or any of those kinds of things. There are other interpretations of the Gemara, but I'm going to use this as an excuse to not have to deal with anything that came before Adam. So Adam was created, according to Jewish tradition, on the sixth day of creation, sixth day of creation, which according to Rabbi Yeshua was in Nisan, and according to Rabbi Eliezer was in Tishrei, and according to Tosfos was in both, but whenever it is, our 6,000 years of counting starts from Adam HaRishon. That's the beginning, nearly the beginning of the Chumash, and I know that doesn't really fit in with the earliest Homo sapiens, but it does fit in if you look on the chart on the left. In round numbers, that's the beginning of city dwelling. That's the beginning of, according to the non-Jewish sources, that's the beginning of people living together in communities as opposed to families of kind of hunter-gatherers. The beginning of city building. The earliest forms of writing cuneiform and early hieroglyphics date from that time. So it's, in a sense, it's the beginning of any kind of history of peoples as opposed to individuals. That is what, just so we understand, who wrote the Torah? Very simply, who wrote the Torah?
Hashem.
Okay, Hashem. Good. Who wrote the Torah? So we could read it. Right, Moshe wrote the Torah. He wrote the Torah, 2,500 years after Adam was created. So what he was writing down wasn't a contemporary history of creation, but he was writing down God's dictation of how God wanted us to understand that God created the world. In other words, It wasn't a blow-by-blow eyewitness account of what happened. And therefore, there's all sorts of room to be flexible with what the message is that God wants us to learn from the stories of creation, all the stories from the beginning of Bereshit up until the Exodus from Egypt, basically. From Exodus from Egypt, we're supposed to believe that these are, we do believe, that these, this is an eyewitness account of what actually happened, that Moshe was recording as it happened. But anything that happened before that is the stories that God told him to write in the way that God told him to write them. Again, I don't want to get into a whole thing of that, but... Yes.
Is it, it's not in sequential order?
Usually the Torah is in sequential order, unless there's a reason for it not to be.
Which happens.
But usually that happens in the stories from Moshe onwards. Well, except for Terach dying before his time. Yeah, but in general, it is in sequential order. But, yeah, okay. So we have, for example, from Adam until Noah, we know there were 10 generations. The Mishnah tells us in Pirkei Avos there were 10 generations. Not the Mishnah here, a different Mishnah, Pirkei Avos, I didn't put on the source sheet. And the Torah records those 10 generations and how old they were when they had children. Oh, they, meaning the men, the women are completely inconsequential. How old the man was when he sired a son, and how old he was when he died. And these dates, these years, basically on average they had children about the age of 100, except for Noah, who was 500 when he had his children. And they basically died in the late 800s, early 900s, except for Hanoch, who died at the very young age of 365. So there are many different explanations of how people lived so long, or indeed whether people lived so long in those times. There is an opinion that says that nobody lived that long. These are the teachings of this person lasted. The world used this approach for this number of years and then switched to a different approach in different society. There is an opinion, the Rambam says, that only the person mentioned lived that long, but everybody else lived normal lives, and normal lifespans. And for some reason, God made these enormous lifespans so he could have 10 generations. There is, of course, the vegetarian option, which is that before the flood, it was forbidden to eat meat, and therefore people lived much healthier lives and lived much longer. What I'm saying is that even though the Torah is giving us information, it doesn't necessarily have to be historical information in the simplest literal understanding of it. It may be, it could be, and if that's what works, then great. But what I'm trying to, what I would like to show is more a story of the Jewish people. So if we go back to, yeah.
Sorry, but we know that the numbers are correct because Abraham knew Noah, correct? So in other words, that those numbers of the long lives of 800 years or whatever it is, it's correct because Abraham knew Noah.
How do we know Abraham knew Noah? Because of those numbers.
Can you know more about it?
Don't think so.
Isn't there a Gemara about what somebody way later knowing something way earlier? So
there is a statement about Yaakov knowing being three generations away from Adam and Risha.
But one of them knew, I just remember something about them knowing that, they actually studied together in yeshiva.
But Yaakov went to yeshiva Shem and Eva.
And knew one of the guys who were like.
And Shem, right. But again, that's even less reliable. Oh no, let me say it differently. That's even. There's as much as the Torah has a literal meaning, so we can take that as literal. When we have a statement of the Talmud, there may in fact not be a literal. The literal meaning may be the wrong meaning, and it may be only a metaphorical meaning. The Torah has to. I'm not saying it's not true. It may well be true.
Right.
But it, I'm not really. Right now, I don't really. It doesn't really bother me whether it's true or not true, because there's a story that's being told, and I think the story is, the world starts with Adam and Eve knowing God, being given one mitzvah in the Garden of Eden, which they very quickly broke. In fact, the Gemara goes through the hours of that first day of the creation of Adam, and it turns out that it wasn't even one whole hour from the time he was commanded, they were commanded, till they sinned. But Adam and Eve knew God, and clearly were not worshipping idols and had no other false gods. After they were kicked out of the Garden of Eden, they were given six mitzvot, the famous seven mitzvahs b'nei Noach, so were given six of them, and the seventh, which was to do with eating meat, was waited until Noach. But Adam's grandson, who was Enosh, in that generation they already started worshipping idols, or at least making a mistake that led to idolatry. So if you look in source number 4 on page 2, the Torah says, Ben the Shes, who is Adam's and Eve's son, had a son. They cried Shema Enosh. He was called Enosh, which interestingly means mortal as well. As Huchal Likro B'Shem Hashem. At that time, they began to call in the name of God. And there are different interpretations of what this means, but one explanation, certainly how Rambam understands it, is that at that time, they started to call false gods who weren't God. So even though I translated it as the name of the Eternal with a capital E, it may well be the name of God with a small g. And the Rambam in Mishneh Torah, source number 5, says that in the days of Enosh, the people made a great mistake, and this was their mistake. It said, since God created the stars and spheres to run the world and placed them in the heavens, giving them great honor, and they are the servants to serve God, it is appropriate to praise them, glorify them, and give them honor. And they started worshipping God through intermediaries. And that was the beginning of idolatry, and from there was a slippery slope until the whole world was filled with idolatry, and very few people, in fact, knew who God was. And then the world is destroyed, and then Noah and his and the flood, and the Torah talks about the development of agriculture at the time of Noah, which matches up approximately with the invention of the plow and the Bronze Age happened at different times in different places and different things, so I'm not sure about that. Avram comes along in 1948, which is a very memorable date to modern historians. Born in 1948 from the creation of the world, which is 1812, which is also a memorable number, but this is BCE. And he comes from Ur Kasdim, which is in Iraq, and moves to Israel. And this is the matches up with the end of the Sumerian dynasty, which had been one of the major world powers at the time. Avraham was 48 years old when the Tower of Babel was built and when the nations were all dispersed. And that's basically, at that time, he recognized God, he understood what was going on, and that's the end of the 2,000 years of emptiness, 2,000 years of chaos, and begins the 2,000 years of Torah, when Avraham recognizes God and starts trying to tell everybody else in the world about God. 1996 or 2000, depending on whether Avraham was 48. He was 48 at the time of the Tower of Babel, so it may have been 4 years later that he started actually proselytizing.
What was the year, 66?
2000. 1996 or...
Unusual.
Good trick, right? Which coincidentally matched up with the Code of Hammurabi, and very nice. Okay, so then we have Avram Yitzchak and Yaakov, and all the stories of Bereishis, and then in Shemot, the Israelites, who are not yet Jewish, because they don't become Jewish until the destruction of the, or the very end of the first temple period, but they're the children of Yisrael, of Yaakov. They come down to Egypt. Again, the Machlokes in Rashi and Ramban and all sorts of other people, but basically sometime around 2238, and they were in Egypt for 210 years, even though the Torah says they'll be there for 400 years, which is why there's some confusion as to dates. And then we have now, after 200 years in Egypt and the slavery and the Exodus, we have 2448 is the Exodus from Egypt and the Torah being given. So the history of from here until the Mishnah is very neatly summed up in source number 3 on page 2 in Pirkei Avos, which is Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai. Moshe got the Torah at Sinai, Umasra Yeshua, and gave it to Yeshua. We know that because Moshe taught Yeshua. And Yeshua is Kenim. Yeshua gave it over to the Zakenim, who were the people of his generation. It was Kenim the Nevi'im. The Zakenim gave it to the Nevi'im. It's not clear who the Nevi'im are or for how long. And the Nevi'im gave it to Anshei Knesset HaGdola, who were the beginning of the Second Temple period. So the Mishnah very neatly jumps from kind of 2488 to about 3408, which is, you know, a nice 1,000 year. Is that right? Yeah. About 1,000 years is summarized in 3 words in the Mishnah. 1,000 years of Jewish history. So never trust the Mishnayos if you think it's historical. But it is telling a message that there was very little change in the Torah from the time Moshe received it at Mount Sinai until the men of the Great Assembly. And then after the exile in Babel and they came back and rebuilt the second temple, we find a brand new Judaism, which we're going to talk about hopefully, if we have time, which I hope we will. So again, this is going to be covered in the oral law classes and the halakha classes and all sorts of other things, but very basically, when we say Moshe got the Torah, what did he actually get at Mount Sinai?
The tablets.
So he got the tablets. We don't know what was written on those tablets either, but he got two tablets. Right.
I thought we did know.
Yeah, what?
Ten Commandments.
Okay, maybe. There's a machlokas in the Gemara whether it was five commandments and five commandments or the same Ten Commandments written twice on two tablets. And then we'll see, and then the Ramban wrote a whole book showing that the Ten Commandments contain the entire Torah,
right,
all 613 mitzvahs, and we're going to see there's a lot more as well. But, okay, you've got two tablets of something. Sorry.
And also Torah
Shebal Peh. Also Torah Shebal Peh, also Torah Shebichtav, also Nach. Yeah?
What do you mean changed from
after? We'll get there, hopefully. So there's... I haven't got time to talk about Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, who are wonderful personalities. But if you look in source number 6, Reish Lakish, Rav Shimon ben Lakish says, what's the meaning of the verse, Ve'etna lachet luchot ha'evan, Ve'atorah v'amitzvah shekasavdi laharosam? Right? I give you the tablets of stone and the law and the commandments which I have written that you may teach them. So each word, tablets of stone is the Ten Commandments. Great. The law is the Chumash. The commandment is the Mishnah, which I've written. Because the Mishnah wasn't written, right? So, written must be Nach, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, the prophets and the writings. That you may teach is the Gemara, which is the commentary on the Mishnah. And therefore, Reish Lakish learns that all of these things were given to Moshe on Sinai. Now, if that is true, let's do the source number 7, which is the name of Rabbi Yochanan, even though I didn't write it in the English. Rabbi Yochanan says, a different verse in Devarim Tes. Va'aleim k'chol ha'dvarim asher dibar Hashem imachem baha. Everything, according to all the words which the Lord had spoken with you on the mountain, we infer from this that God revealed to Moshe that it should be all the... this is not my translation, sorry. All the particulars of the Chumash, and it was all the details, all the droshes, everything where this word really means something else, and we learn this halakha from the Chumash, and all the details that the Gemara learns out from the Mishnah, and all the halakhas that in the future the rabbis were going to introduce. And since it's a Gemara Megillah, here it's referring specifically to Mikra Megillah, the mitzvah of reading the Megillah. Moshe Rabbeinu knew, standing on the Mount Sinai, that the Jews were going to be in exile in Babel and then in Persia, and then that Esther was going to get married to Ahasuerus, and that Haman was going to kill, and they were going to write it all down, and it was going to be a mitzvah of Mikra Megillah. If these two Gemaras are understood literally, then nobody ever since Moshe can ever say anything new in Torah ever again. Right? It's all been said. And really, all we can do is just try and sit and meditate and remember what it was that God said to Moshe and try and say it. So nobody understands it like that. There are many different understandings or explanations of what that means. And of course, if you know the Gemara of Moshe Rabbeinu seeing Rabbi Akiva and not understanding what Rabbi Akiva was talking about, you'll see that it's a very strange topic, which again is another shiur that I would like to give, but not now. The one explanation, Tiferes Yisrael says that even though Moshe was told all this information, he only gave a very small part of it to the people when he came down from the mountain. In other words, Moshe was privy to information, but only those things that God said, Vayedaber Adonai el Moshe Lemor, only those things that God said to Moshe Lemor to say over, that he was allowed to say. The rest was his private information, which he happened to know, but which is irrelevant for us because it was never passed, handed on from Moshe and never passed down. And so when we say things, we're really saying something brand new, just that Moshe happened to know the future, know we were going to say it. But we are in fact saying new things, and when the rabbis make new mitzvahs, they're in fact new mitzvahs, except that Moshe happened to know about these new mitzvahs that were going to happen. Which I think is, which makes me much happier than saying we're just trying to tap into something that's already... each of us has a piece of Torah that we can say, which it so happens once we say it, that will be what Moshe saw on Mount Sinai, but until we say it, it doesn't exist in the world. So that's the Torah. Okay, so then we have the Bible. The Chumash, right, takes us into going into Eretz Yisrael, 2488. Then we have the Nevi'im. The Yeshua is the book of conquest of Israel. That whole book lasts 14 years, 20 years. It's not a particularly long book historically. Sefer Shoftim is one big disaster. Really, the Jews should have come into Israel and appointed a king and built the base of Mikdash, and Mashiach should have come, and that would have been the end of the story, and everything would have been wonderful. Instead, we had this era of judges, whatever they were, which is basically the Jews did the wrong thing, and God sent another country, another nation to attack them, and eventually the Jews did tshuva, and God saved them, and then they did the wrong thing again, and God sent another country to attack them, and then they did tshuva, and God saved them again. And it's just one disaster after another, with a couple of nice stories. You know, Devorah and her palm tree is a beautiful story in the middle of all this disaster, and Shimshon is a horrible story, but it became like a great story. And just to put that in context, the weather Theseus and the Trojan War and the Ulysses, the Odysseus, whether those things are true or legendary, because Homer obviously lived several hundred years later, but if those are true, they may be based on real facts, and that happened at the same kind of time that Sefer Shoftim and beginning of Malachim was happening in Israel. It occurred to me, just to step aside for a minute from being a religious believing Jew, if you were just an anthropologist looking at the culture, what kind of stories did the Jews say about their origins, and what kind of stories did the Greeks say about their origins? I think it's very interesting that you get a very different set of values or goals, or apart from the number of gods and theological issues, but all of the Greek stories are about a mighty warrior hero overcoming some evil, nasty, tricky person. And very often the hero also is treacherous and tricky and nasty, and a lot of killing on a lot of heroes. Whereas our history is almost exactly the opposite. It's a lot of messing up and doing the wrong thing and saying sorry afterwards, and complete dependence on God rather than trying to outwit God. There's just a thought that I had, which you can either think about or ignore or whatever. So then we have Sefer Malachim, which is what should have happened from the beginning when we came into Israel, and King David and the Beis HaMikdash is built sometime around. Now the chronology gets rather tricky because of the missing 165 years, which we're going to get to. So I don't really want to spend a lot of time on that, but it's a very interesting topic. But the first temple was built by Shlomo HaMelech, and we know exactly what day of the week it was and what day of the month it was, and but we don't know what year it was necessarily. I think Gemara in Rosh Hashanah makes a Gezeirah Shava. This was 40 years from that, and 20 years from that. And okay. So the Beis HaMikdash was built. And then, after that, the rest of Malachim is basically another disaster. With a few good kings, you've got Chizkiyahu and you've got Yoshia. You've got a couple of good kings in... First of all, the kingdom is split between Israel and Judah, the northern and the southern kingdoms. The northern kingdom, forget about it. Just doesn't work. There's no... None of the kings were able to have their son take over as the next king. It's just one coup after another in the whole northern kingdom. In the southern kingdom, they were... son after son and descended from David, but almost all of them messed up, and almost all of the people messed up, and almost everything is just stories of either doing tshuva or not doing tshuva. Eliyahu HaNavi, for example, was coming to tell Achav and Izebel of to shape up or ship out. And okay, fine, so that's all first temple. The first temple, the Gemara says, stood for 410 years, and the second temple stood for 420 years. Those are definite numbers that we have in the Gemara. Now, at some point, the 10 tribes were exiled. Probably not all at once. Probably Gad and Reuben. Reuben and Gad, who are on the other side of the Jordan, were exiled slightly earlier. In the north, Dan may have been exiled earlier. But when Sancheriv came and nearly destroyed Yerushalayim, that was the end of the northern kingdom, and he introduced the Samaritans, people, brought them into the Babylonians, when they conquered a country, they removed the population that lived there and put them in a different place and brought in a population from somewhere else and switched them around so that they wouldn't be able to rebel against their new rulers if they're in a place that's not their home. There's nothing really for them to fight for, and they don't have the security and ability to fight. And therefore, the group of people who nowadays are called the Samaritans or the Shomronim were brought in by Sancherev from some other place and basically became Jewish because they were being eaten by lions, and they decided it was better to be Jewish than to be eaten by lions. And then soon after it was decided that it wasn't that bad being eaten by lions after all. So the Samaritans, who, I mean, still what's it called? Hargrizim and Harivah. Right, Harbracha. There still is, although most of them now have moved to close to the sea, but there is a community of Shomronim, and they still do the Korban Pesach, and they still celebrate Sukkot, and they still do all sorts of things in their own way. So that happened at the time of the exile of the Ten Tribes. Northern and southern, after Shlomo died. Rechavam and Yeravam, his son and one of his servants, fought and split up the kingdom. So the whole, and it could be that all during the period of Judges also, there was not one country but disparate groups of people on the same country. So it may well be that David HaMelech united all the Jews into one kingdom. His son Shlomo built the Beis HaMikdash, and after that they split up again into different kingdoms.
Then we never unite again.
Well, yeah. That's the whole, all the Haftorahs in Bereshit, the end of Bereshit there, about whether or not the ten tribes will come back or they won't come back. Yirmiyahu brought them back, he will, he won't. And in the meantime, we're not doing very well about being united. Okay, so we have, again, we don't know what happened to the ten tribes, even though there are people today looking for them and finding them and all sorts of claims of who is and who isn't. It's not clear whether we're supposed to be looking for the ten tribes or not. It's not clear whether they will come back when Mashiach comes or they won't come back, or whether they are already back, or we don't really know what happened. It's one of those things, don't ask that kind of a question. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed on Tisha B'Av. It was actually destroyed in stages. The actual building was destroyed on Tisha B'Av. Before that, the king Tzidkiah was taken into exile. Before that, the rabbis, the leaders, were taken into exile. After that, the remnants who remained on, the last remnants of Jewish authority in Israel ended with Gedaliah ben Achikam after the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash. So because of the confusion as to when the Beis HaMikdash was actually, when you're supposed to start counting the destruction of the temple, there was confusion as to when the second temple would be built. There was a prophecy from Yirmiyahu and also in Daniel that there would be an exile of 70 years. But the Gemara Megillah goes through all the different non-Jewish kings who tried to calculate the 70 years and couldn't quite manage to do so, and celebrated too early and then got killed. And that's Achashverosh, the beginning of the Purim story. Achashverosh's feast is celebrating the fact the 70 years are up and the Beis HaMikdash hasn't been rebuilt, and therefore the Jews are staying where they are. And that's why he brought out the fancy dishes and cups and things from the temple. And the result of that was that Vashti was killed, and then Esther became queen, and their son allowed the Jews to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. They had started building the temple before that. Haman's son stopped them. So very interesting stuff happening over there. So in the 70-year exile, from the end of the first temple to the beginning of the second temple, there's a missing 165 years, meaning the historical records of Persian kings and the Jewish records of Persian kings are out by 165 years. And there's different explanations as to why that should be and how to reconcile. And in the Gemara, it's clear that there's confusion as to how to calculate 70. In contemporary academic circles, it's clear there's confusion. I don't know what the answer is, or I know several different answers. So what happens? Until we have almost no archaeological independent evidence to back up anything that happens up until this time. Right? We know it's true because it says so in the Tanakh and in the Mishnah and the Gemara. Until the Jews come back from Babel, that's when we really start having a little bit of records of what happened.
Isn't there other cultures or other peoples that have similar records to ours that would prove it?
There's nothing definitely conclusive. People look for things and find things or don't find things, and there may be, I'm not saying there's not evidence, I'm not saying it's not true, but it was just, we don't have any, you know, coins saying King David on them, as far as I know. We don't have any definite 100% archaeological evidence of that, which is fine, nor would you necessarily expect to, because everything was rebuilt in the same place that it was destroyed. And so there's no, it's not surprising that we don't have, and there's very little that would leave records. There are things of Jews going to Baal. There's all sorts of stories that may well match up, but I don't think if there's anything, it's very, very little that's definitely 100% this. We know for sure this happened.
I'm sorry, where is there a gap? So you're saying that the 70 years there's no count for them in the Gemara, like that are missing from
the Gemara? Does calculate them. It calculates four different ways of working out the 70 years. The problem is like this. The first temple stood for 410 years. The second temple stood for 420 years. We know when the second temple was destroyed. We have records from Josephus. The second temple was destroyed in 69-70. So we can work out about 420 years from that. But we know when the first temple was built, and there's missing years. And that's the problem.
So we don't know when it was.
So either the first temple stood longer than... Or actually, we know when Nebuchadnezzar lived as well. So either the second temple was built earlier than it should have been, or more likely, the 70-year gap was actually 230 years. And we call it 70 years for some reason, which has all sorts of meanings, but is not necessarily literally historically true. Or there may be some way of calculating it to make 230 equal 70. Well, it doesn't match up with Persian records.
Oh, it doesn't have to?
Well,
you're saying he wants collaborative proof from...
Not only that, but we talk about the king. We have five of the kings. We have Koresh, Daryavish, Achashverosh, Daryavish, Koresh, who were the kings of Persia. In the Gemara, it talks about these are the kings and whatever, and the Persians have records of their kings, and there's many more than that. I can't remember, like another 12 or something. We're not counting. And there is independent evidence for that, and whatever it is. I just, the numbers, if my numbers are wrong, I'm going to blame the missing years. That's what I'm saying. When you match up the Jewish years to the non-Jewish years, either it works or it doesn't work, and I'm not all that fussed because it's again, there's a story rather than... sorry, someone else have a question? So the Jews come back from Babel. Now, the academics like to say this is when they became monotheists, that they picked up from the Zoroastrians in Babel, which is utter tosh, obviously. But it is true that when the Jews came back from Babel, first of all, important to know that most of them did not come back. Most of the Jews who were... two important things. First important thing to know is not all the Jews went to Babel. There were always Jews who remained in Israel. There was no political leadership, there was no authority, there were no leaders, but there were always Jews in Israel. From the time that Joshua came into Israel until the present day, there have always been Jews living in Israel, even when all the Jews were kicked out. Second thing is, when the Jews went to Babel, all the leaders, all the wealthy people, all the religious, political, and financial leaders were in Babel. Very few of them came back to Israel when the temple was rebuilt. There were several attempts to rebuild the temple. The final successful one was Nehemiah came back with a very small group of people and started building. Ezra, after his Rebbe passed away, came to Israel bringing a bunch of rejects, basically. People who couldn't find Shidduchim in Babel because of all sorts of family issues came to Eretz Israel, and he managed to play the political game and get the temple rebuilt, even though it wasn't built in the same way, but they managed to start having sacrifice and get things going. that's not the temple, that's not the Kotel. The Kotel and the pictures of the second Beis HaMikdash date from the Herodian period, which is at the very end of the Second Temple period. But Ezra and Nehemiah came back with a group of people, and so we'll talk about in a second. Yeah.
Why didn't people come back?
Life was good.
But
just like today.
Yeah, but is it anything beyond that?
I'm sure. sure it's exactly the same reasons that people today say that they can't come and live in Israel. My family's here, my work's here, my money's here, my rabbi's here, we're waiting for Mashiach to come.
It's dangerous.
It's dangerous, right? All those reasons, I'm sure, are also true. And the truth is that really the centers of Jewish learning, they were alternated between Babel and Israel. Well, there's a bit of a black hole. We don't know very much about the beginning of the Second Temple period. But there was religious leadership in Babel and religious leadership in Eretz Israel. The rabbis in Israel made themselves more important by making all sorts of rules. For example, Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctifying the new moon, can only be done in Israel. And all sorts of... But they were sending messengers to Babel to tell them what time was Rosh Chodesh, because most of the Jews live in Babel.
Was there like a difference between when Jews returned to Israel, when there was a temple, and when there wasn't a temple, in terms of people coming back? Like when the temple was fully built, did more people come?
I don't think so. What Ezra did, one of the many things he did, he was a good fundraiser, he was a good public relations man, which is why the book's called Ezra, and like Nehemiah kind of just gets a look in as a second part of Ezra, even though Nehemiah did a lot of the work. What Ezra did in the Gemara, or the Mishnah, at the end of Kiddushin, talks about the fact that Ezra found a way to work out who was a mamzer and who wasn't a mamzer, who was kosher to get married, who wasn't, who could get married to who. So all the people who, like I said, who couldn't find shidduchim, all the people who weren't rich and famous, came with Ezra, and then he sorted them all out and made different groups of people who got married with each other, and that's why it was attractive for those people to come back. But everyone who was sorted with the right bloodlines and with the money and everything else stayed in Babel. There were people who came back. Mordechai came back. Mordechai from the Purim story was one of the people who came back to Eretz Israel. And when they came back at some point, they made Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the men of the Great Assembly.
When was that, after the Purim story?
Yes. Mordechai was one of the men of the Great Assembly.
Right, he was the head of the Sanhedrin, no?
I don't know if he was the head, I'm not sure. Ezra, it's not clear. Ezra was also the head, and Daniel was the head, and Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Historically, it's a little bit odd. We know the end of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah was the time of Alexander the Great, because Shimon HaTzadik met Alexander, and we know exactly when Alexander lived. So that was the end of the men of the Great Assembly. So it probably wasn't just a one-time thing, but probably went on for many decades. What they did, though, in this men of the Great Assembly is changed Judaism radically. And this is what I said before. They were now creating a Judaism for exile. Most of the Jews lived in exile. Even though they'd rebuilt the temple, they knew it was going to be temporary. The first temple they thought would last forever. Once it's been destroyed once, the second one they knew was going to be temporary. They instituted prayer as well as sacrifice, which later became in place of sacrifice. They instituted almost all of the the vast majority of rabbinic rules that we have in the Mishnah and in the Gemara were set up by the men of the Great Assembly as a response to living in exile, as a response to having to cope with a different reality of Judaism. The men of the Great Assembly wrote the Tanakh, or at least not that they wrote it, they codified it. They decided what was part of Tanakh and what was not part of Tanakh. And the Gemara records disputes about whether Shir Hashirim should be part of Tanakh or not be part of Tanakh, whether Megillas Esther should be part of Tanakh or not be part of Tanakh. After that time, nothing else gets into Tanakh. So they wrote down the Bible. Again, they took existing manuscripts, but they decided that, you know, this book is in and that book is out. There are, for example, Ben Sira is a book very similar to Mishlei. Mishlei is part of Tanakh, Ben Sira is not. And the Mishnah in Sanhedrin says that anyone who reads Ben Sira is a heretic. So they codified the Bible. They probably codified who is a Jew and who's not a Jew.
That was the Great Assembly?
Men of the Great Assembly.
When?
Beginning of the Second Temple period. No, this is the end. Beginning of the Second Temple. I've put down here the 353 before the Common Era in round numbers. They, until the Jews went into Babel, they were basically called by the tribal affiliation. If you were from the north, you were Israeli. If you were from the south, you were Yehudi. When people become when Jews become Jewish, become Yehudim, when they start speaking a language of Jews, that's only when they go into exile. The first mention, the second mention. Mordechai is called Mordechai Yehudi. There is another mention in Yechezkel of someone speaking a language called Yehudi. But Mordechai is the first Yehudi, or at least the first one recorded, and Judaism now becomes much more than a family. It becomes more delineated religion. Again, the Torah laws were there. People were keeping the mitzvahs. Monotheism, they were from the time of Avraham Avinu. But the rabbinic rules that we have now, laws of muktzah, laws of what you can speak about on Shabbos, what you can't speak about on Shabbos, laws of all the laws of tefillah and brachot, every area of Judaism, everything that's a Durabanan, almost everything that's Durabanan, comes from the men of the Great Assembly. There's a radical change in Judaism. Radical in a couple of ways. Not only did they change practice, but that means you're changing. They understood that they were allowed to make changes in Judaism. They're allowed to add to what God had said, even though the Torah says don't add anything to this, but they did, and they justified doing so. And they basically gave the authority to all future generations of rabbis to be able to interpret and change and do things. By making a canon of Tanakh, they gave people something from which to derive halacha. You gave a textbook, a source book, from which you can now find this halacha that we do. We can find its located in this verse over here in the Torah. Or, I mean, they had the Torah before, but reading Torah, weekly Torah reading, Men of the Great Assembly. Monday, Thursday, Torah reading, Men of the Great Assembly. Gemara says Moshe Rabbeinu established the market days, Monday, Thursday, based in sitting Monday and Thursday. All of these things that we, main fundamental Judaism, come from the Men of the Great Assembly. Yeah, sorry, who are
they? You said about that they instituted the prayer, right? So they did that when the second base of English was still around.
At the beginning, yeah.
Whilst they were still making sacrifices.
Yes. Yes.
So they did both?
Yes.
And then when the base of English was trying to stop the sacrifice of Aaron?
Yes.
Again,
there were prayers. People did pray before that, but they codified. These are the prayers that you should say. This is the Shemona Asra. It wasn't whatever. This is the these are the words that you should say. This is you should pray three times a day. This is how all these kinds of things came from.
Was it like just that they had prophecy, right? I mean, did we say that they had prophecy?
Oh, the Men of the Great Assembly was the end of the time of prophecy.
The end of prophecy. So, like, they could prophesy, so they knew.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously what was going to happen, and therefore they instituted the prayer, right?
Yes. Yes, and they knew they were right because they're prophets who validated what they were doing. Yes. Yes.
How did they know that their second temple was going to be destroyed?
Were
there a million prophets running around prophesying that
Yeah, at the first temple everyone was saying the temple won't be destroyed. The second temple, I mean, it didn't look like a proper building. It was like a bit of a material, four curtains and an altar in the middle. And when they started off, yeah.
Only lasted 210 years.
420 years.
That was the first temple, no?
410 is the first temple. 420 is the second. Altogether, but it started off as just a tent and ended up Herod rebuilt it, but
right.
Only the very end.
So that's what we've got. That's what
the Kotel is. The Kotel is one of the structural walls of the mountain that Herod leveled to make a bigger base of Mikdash. It's actually part of the temple itself.
He
levelled the top of the mountain to make more space.
Yeah.
That was a hill with a little temple. Second temple. He knocked the top of the mountain off and built walls. He just kind of landfill. Filled
so
it up.
Yeah, that sounds like the base and then
where the mosque is that he flattened that whole area out and he built the temple there.
Yeah.
That was a response to inflation and unemployment. Right? When you're faced with unemployment and the stock market crashes, you embark on public investment in infrastructure. And nowadays they build roads and schools and big projects like that. But then he said, let's rebuild the temple and solve the unemployment problem. And made an enormous
it was Herod?
Thing from Herod, yeah.
I thought it was Darius, the son of...
Darius allowed the Jews, or Cyrus, Darius, well, it's not clear, allowed the Jews to go back and start building the temple.
But Herod...
Herod only built what we have, the pictures that we see of the temple. Is from
Jewish
king. He is Machlokas.
Is Machlokas whether he was Jewish?
Yes. Yes, but he killed anyone who said he wasn't, so he became Jewish very quickly.
Why would a non-Jew rebuild the second temple?
Yeah, unemployment. He was a Roman vassal. He answered to the Caesars. When the people had no work, obviously, then you start rebelling against the king, so you keep them busy. And also made a name for himself. He rebuilt Maas Machpelah, right, is a Herodian building. Herodian is a Herodian building. Masada is a Herodian building.
But the workers were Jews.
Yes. Yes. Okay, so that is the end of prophecy. That is the end, the amendment of the Great Assembly, is the end of idolatry, basically. I'm going to run out of time, but in source number 8, the Gemara in Yom, I'm not going to read it, but it says that the men of the Great Assembly destroyed the evil inclination for idolatry. Anything we have nowadays is only a pale imitation of what idolatry really was. Nobody runs after idolatry in the way they used to in those days.
That's what I thought until I went to Asia.
Yeah, okay, I know, everyone says that. I hear that, but they got rid of whatever it was they got rid of, they got rid of it. At the same time, that was the end of prophecy. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi were the last three prophets. They were members of the son and Shekinah. Anshei Knesset Gedolah was 120 people, 120 men, rabbis. A normal Sanhedrin is 70 or 71, Machlokas. So they made, that's why it's called Gedolah, they were bigger, because they were 120.
What's the difference in terms of their power?
So there's a halacha that a Beis Din can only overturn, or a Sanhedrin can only overturn a ruling of an earlier Sanhedrin if they are bigger in wisdom and in number. And now Shekinah is Gedolah, so we've got everyone here, 120 people, so you can never overturn us. That's it, we're binding. It's going back to earlier. Yeah, so that's correct. It's a radical change in Judaism. I mean, if you read the verses in Ezra, it seems that people didn't even know what the Chumash was. He read the Chumash out to people. He called everyone come to Jerusalem, read out the Chumash, taught them the halachas.
Ezra.
So
that was only instituted in the second temple period.
It means that the average man on the street had forgotten a lot of the Torah and a lot of the halachas, and Ezra re-energized the people in Eretz Israel. In Babel probably they had, but I'm sure that they had.
So you're saying in Babel they were independently learning Chumash?
Yes, I've got no evidence for that, but yes, it must be true.
You would assume, otherwise there would be no Jews.
Correct,
right.
Otherwise the academics could be right and Judaism would be a fake, so it can't be. Okay, second temple, again, we know there was Anshei Knesset Gedolah. We know what the rules they made. We know some of who they were, but we don't know exactly when they were or what was going. Shimon HaTzadik, we know, was the last of the men of the Great Assembly, because it says on Mishnah Pirkei Avos. Shimon HaTzadik met Alexander the Great, Alexander of Macedonia, who died in 323 BCE. That's the time when the seven wonders of the ancient world were built, approximately. And both the Jewish sources and the non-Jewish sources say that Aristotle was the tutor of Alexander, which is very interesting. It means that the Greeks, the flowering, the high point of Greek philosophy coincided with the transition in Judaism from prophecy to chokhmah, from prophecy to rabbinic interpretation. Whereas in the same way that the Greeks were developing logic and understanding the world using their minds and constructing world views, Judaism made a similar shift. And the Seder Olam Rabban, source number nine. Now people interpret this different ways, and I'll say it a different way next time as well. But Seder Olam Rabban says, right, Amar Melech Gibor, that's Alexander. Alexander's Mokdom, he ruled for 12 years. Ad Kanhu Nevi'im Mitzna Bim Baruch HaKodesh, until the time of Alexander, which is the end of the men of the Great Assembly, there were prophets prophesying with Ruach HaKodesh. Mikan ve'elech hot az nachar shma divrei chachamim. From that time on, listen to the rabbis.
Sorry, what's the
Seder Olam Rabbah is the earliest Jewish history book. It was written by, allegedly, it was written by Tana Rabbi Yossi, Resba Chalifta, who lived, Yossi Bar Chalifta. Don't ask me how to spell that because I don't know. He lived just after the destruction of the Second Temple. And he wrote a book of Jewish history from Adam until his time, basically. Or until Alexander. Recording historical events. And most of Rashi's historical commentary is based on Seder Olam Rabbah. The Ramban, when Rashi says something historical, he'll quote Seder Olam Rabbah. We know that Yishmael lived this many years and Yaakov this, Seder Olam Rabbah is the source for most of Rashi's commentaries. It's from the time of the Mishnah. It's authoritative. Ramban disagrees with him all over the place. But Seder Olam Rabbah is certainly the most authentic Jewish history book. Whether it's true in the way we understand true nowadays, or whether it's a book of history in the way that the Greeks had books of history, I don't know. But it's authentic Jewish. So, and again, this could be interpreted different ways. But one interpretation is, and it certainly seems historically to be, there was a transition at that time from prophecy to rabbinic Judaism. From prophecy meaning biblical Judaism based on Torah laws to Judaism now including rabbinic laws. Now, you'll have many shiurim on which rabbis can make rules and when you have to listen to them, when you don't, and what's binding and what's not. Not every rabbi can say things that you have to listen to, but the men of the Great Assembly made Judaism what it is today. There were later, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, after the destruction of the Second Temple, changed things. For example, the fact that we have Lulav and Esrog for all the days of Sukkot, 7 days of Sukkot, is only after the destruction of the Second Temple. Before that, Lulav and Esrog was only used in the first day outside of Jerusalem. We don't blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah when it falls on Shabbos, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, which ended after the destruction of the Second Temple. There was again a change, but a much more minor change, much fewer things changed then. And there was also some other things after Rabbi Yehuda Nasi made some takanot, most of which are binding, a short while after the destruction of the Temple. But most of rabbinic Judaism, most of the things that we call Dirabanan, come from Anshei Knesset Gdola. Now, I'm going to run out of time, I'm going to go very quickly. And so in the Gemara, Bava Basra says that a chacham adif minavi, that a chacham is greater than a navi. Because a navi is limited, he can only say what God tells him to say, but a chacham can interpret and understand things in a different way. Right, and we have Gemara Sanhedrin, source number 11, that says after the last prophets died, then there was no more prophecy, and they had Bat Kol, which is some kind of minor form of prophecy, and Hillel could have had that. We then have another change, which is we have Chashmonaim of Hanukkah, right? That's an interesting story, right? There are lots of Hanukkah stories. Again, that's 135. There's a lot of archaeological effort. If you go to Modi'in, everywhere you go, you can't move without kicking a flask of oil and all Chashmonaim stuff. All sorts of great stuff. That's still during the Second Temple. That was right. The Greeks took control of the Second Temple, but did not destroy it. And the Chashmonaim came and reclaimed the Second Temple, and fantastic. And then they very quickly killed themselves out and became as Greek as the Greeks were, and gave each other, and we called their children names like Jason and Aristobulus and all sorts of wonderful Greek names. Although, of course, many Jews are called Alexander. After Alexander Mokdon came to Yerushalayim, they made a rule that everyone had to call their children Alexander. Any boys born were called Alexander, which is why you have Rabbi Alexander in the Mishnah. After the Chashmonaim destroyed themselves, Herod became king. And sometime around then, we have the beginnings of the Mishnah, the earliest Tanaim. That's a machlokas, how to define the earliest Tanaim. The earliest name mentioned in the Mishnah is Shimon HaTzadik, who's in the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. But from him until, and then you've got one statement from Yossi ben Yoezer, one statement from Yossi ben Yochanan, one statement, like, there's people who kind of get a line here and a word there. But really, the development of Mishnah happened with Hillel and Shammai. So, Gemara Pesachim says the Bnei Beseira, whoever Bnei Beteira, they were in Israel, they were the leaders, they were the Nasi'im, they were the halachic arbiters. 1 year, Pesach time, they didn't know what the halacha was about whether you're allowed to shecht your Pesach on Shabbos if Pesach falls Saturday night. Hillel came from Bavel and taught them the halacha, and they made him the Nasi. And from then on, all of the religious leadership in Israel were descendants of Hillel. Anyone who had the title of Nasi was a descendant of Hillel. Furthermore, in Bavel, later in history, anyone who became the leader, the political leader of the Jews in Bavel, was a descendant of Hillel.
Descendant by
biological
blood?
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like
Hillel, Gamliel, Yehuda, all that whole family.
Wasn't from his house, like a team of disciples, you actually said
no.
Blood relatives.
Yes. Yes, there were schools of Hillel and schools
right,
of Shammai,
right,
which are not blood relatives, but the Nasi was always a blood descendant, direct descendant of Hillel.
And the Nasi took the role of like the head of the Sanhedrin, kind of final decision maker.
He was also had to follow the majority ruling. He couldn't on his own make decisions, but he was as much a political leader as a religious leader. Was answerable. We have here in source number 13. The machlokas between the head of the Sanhedrin and the Nasi.
Right. Okay.
And in fact, this is the earliest recorded machlokas in Judaism. I know nowadays we can't imagine a time when there was no machlokas. But Yosef ben Yo'ezer and Yosef ben Yochanan argued about one thing, and that was the first unresolved argument in Judaism. And the same one thing, which is about smicha, which is when you bring a sacrifice on Yontiv, do you put your hands on its head or not? Which seems like a rather trivial point. This same machlokas went through the two Yosefs, Shulman Prachni Tara Bailey, Yudim and Tabe and Shulman Shetach, Shemai and Avtalion. Each of the Nasi and the Avbeistin argued about this same machlokas, and that was the only machlokas. Presumably, simplest explanation is when you have a Sanhedrin to make a final decision on everything, there's no such thing as an unresolved machlokas, because you ultimately put it to the vote. And even though there were lower courts and higher courts and small and whatever it was, there was a supreme court, the Sanhedrin. There were three Sanhedrins in the temple, but the Sanhedrin sat in Lishkat HaGazis, special part of the Beis HaMikdash, was the final decider of any halacha. So there was no machlokas. At some point at the end of the Second Temple period, there was machlokas. And at the end of this chain of... And again, all of those people get a mention and appear in a Mishnah here and a line of Gemara there, but really, so they may be called Tanaim, or they may be proto-Tanaim. Tanai, a Tana is someone who's in the Mishnah. That's, and the Mishnah is whatever anything said from the time of the men of the Great Assembly until the time of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. Then, Hillel and Menachem were the two leaders, and there was no machlokas. Order was restored. Then Menachem left, and we don't know where he went or what happened to him, and Shammai came along, and then there was Machlokes Hillel and Shammai. Hillel and Shammai themselves only had about a dozen arguments of things, but the Talmidim, the Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, argued about absolutely everything. Well, not absolutely everything, that's not true. But there's many, many areas of Judaism were argued about by that. Beis Hillel were more numerous. People like to think Beis Hillel are nicer people. Okay, maybe that's true. Beis Shammai were smarter and were more correct, but the halacha still like Beis Hillel because they were nicer, according to the Gemara and Erevin. Ultimately, after many, many years of arguing, a voice came out of heaven, a bas kol came and said, they're both right, they're both the words of God, but the halacha is like Beis Hillel because they're nicer. So that is the temple's destroyed, which obviously destroys any transmission but makes it very difficult to transmit accurately all of Judaism, which is why there's machlokas, because people are in different places and they're trying to rebuild and remember what they'd learned and weren't able to learn it properly the first time because they're running away from the Romans and whatever was going on. So ultimately, in the approximately year 200, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi took all of the statements of the Tanaim, which had been semi-codified before in different collections of Bryces. He took all of the information that went before and codified, edited the Mishnah, redacted the Mishnah. which then became authoritative Jewish text. That's the starting point for any halacha after that. In the same way that the Tanakh is the basis of any halacha, right? Any halacha from the Mishnah has to be located in a verse in the Torah. So any halacha in a Gemara has to be located in a Mishnah or in a Braisa, which is the equivalent but not actually codified in the book. The Mishnah was not necessarily, probably not written down, and was certainly not written down, which is why any time the Gemara says written, it's always referring to Tanakh. It always uses the word taught, Tana, Shana, something, for Mishnah. It's not written down, but it was codified and was a set thing. It became the text that people use, which the Gemara says. And source number 14, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and Rabbi Nasan are the end of Mishnah. This source sheet?
Yeah.
I'll try. That's easy. So, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi made a change in Judaism, which coincided with the change of authority back from Israel to Babel again, which is that now, instead of using Tanakh as the basis of halacha, you're supposed to use Mishnah as the basis of halacha. And Mishnah is based on Tanakh, but it's now the Gemara is the Amoraim, the people, Amoraim are people who speak in the Gemara. The Amoraim are not allowed to learn halachas from psukim, from verses in Tanakh. They're allowed to quote someone earlier who learnt a halacha from a verse in Tanakh. But Amoraim don't learn things from Tanakh, they learn things from Mishnayos and Braisos. In the same way, right, the Amoraim then were the next 300, 400 years worth of rabbis who derived halachas from the Mishnayos and Braisos. Eventually, those discussions were codified, were redacted by Ravina and Ravashi into the what is today called the Gemara or the Talmud. It was structured based on this Mishnah has this discussion, the next Mishnah has this discussion. Everything was put in order. There were still last-minute changes and editing things done to the Gemara for another couple of 100 years after that. But basically, from that time on, people located halacha in the Gemara. If you want to say the halacha is X, you've got to show me where it says so in the Gemara. Right. Don't show me a verse, because a verse, I don't know what that means. I'm not a Tana. Don't show me a Mishnah, because I know what that means. I'm not an Amora. Show me a Gemara, which says it. And that's another major change in Judaism. Now, this is happening at the same time, for example, as the Council of Nicaea, which is the codification of Christianity. Constantine convened the Council of Nicaea to sort out once and for all what Christian theology was supposed to be. While he's doing that, and a lot of the Gemara, if you understand the backdrop of Christianity going on, the Gemara, you see it as a reaction to theology of the Christian theology that's going on over there. So about the year 550, the Gemara takes shape. We have no copies of the Gemara dating back earlier than about the year 1000. As existing manuscripts. Other than that, there is a Yemenite page or section of Gemara which says that it was copied from an 8th century manuscript. But we don't have anything as old as that existing. As we don't have the Gemara that Rashi looked at when he learned. But what happens after the Gemara is that... the Rambam says that the Mishnah was written and presumably the Gemara was written as a response to turmoil in the political, in the world, that Jews were exiled again from wherever they were dispersed. The Gemara ends, depending on when it was written, the Gemara and the Gaonim are the end of Jewish authority being in Babel. After the Gaonim, who probably put the very final finishing touches on the Gemara, although most of it was organized by then, after the Gaonim, there's no real center of Judaism anymore. during the time of the Gaonim, if you had a question, you'd write to the head of the yeshiva in Bavel and say, here's my question. They'd write back, here's your answer. And we have some writing from the Gaonim. There's no, very few books. It's a lot of responsa, this question, this answer. After the Gemara is finished and finalized, the Gaonim kind of disappear. And we're going to talk tomorrow, hopefully, about the medieval period where we have a whole school of Gemara commentary happening in Europe, whole school of Gemara commentary happening in Spain and in Portugal and Provence, a whole school of actually that's really the different ways of interpreting and learning and understanding the Gemara, which reflect the split between Eretz Yisrael and Babel, which is probably the split between Ashkenazim and Sephardim, which ends up being different approaches to Halacha and Gemara from the time of the Rif and Rashi and Rambam onwards. So until tomorrow.
Thank you.